Okay. Today we're going to talk about the Philistines and also clean up a couple things about the judges. One of the things as we went through the accounts of the different judges I wanted you to be aware of was where they came from. And is that in focus? I didn't think so. Whoops, too fast. Is that better? Or worse? That's worse. That's pretty good. First of all, from which tribe did God raise up Ehud? Yes. All right. Okay, and what enemy did he fight? Okay. And it's not surprising that he was from Benjamin because it was Benjamin and to a degree Ephraim that were being afflicted by the Moabites. And so God chose somebody from the afflicted area. Deborah is from which tribe? Or I should say Dvorah. Sophie? Yes, so from the tribe of Ephraim. And although Ephraim was not suffering from the particular oppression, which was what oppressor at this occasion? The Canaanite League in the north, headed by Hazor, will consider why God used her, because the actual military man, from which tribe did he come from? Barak, from which tribe did he come? Nope. He came from Kadesh, Dash. The name of the town he came from tells you what tribe he's from. It was Kadesh, Dash, and the other part of the city name gives you the tribe. Kadesh Dash Naphtali. It was a Naphtalite. Okay? Gideon, and of course Naphtali was one of those tribes up in the north that was being heavily afflicted by the oppressor. Gideon came from the tribe of Manasseh, and his tribe, of course, was one of those that was being afflicted by the oppressor in his day, which was the Midianites. So, again, you see, there's a logical reason why God raises up a judge from different tribes. He's picking somebody from a tribe which is being afflicted. And Jephthah was from Manasseh across the Jordan, specifically the clan of Gilead. He was of the offspring of Gilead. And again, remember when we read in Judges chapter 10, it was the princes and elders of Gilead who were suffering the affliction and were trying to find somebody to be their military deliverer, indeed going about advertising for one. Now let's consider their social status. From what social stratum does Ehud come? You're skipping Othniel, who came from Judah, simply because we don't have enough information except to presume high-born in the case of Othniel because he was related to Caleb, but that's a bit speculative. Ehud, we have more to go on. Yes. Right. Deborah, from what level of society? Again, the Bible gives us a very clear indication of what level of society she was in. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Why don't you turn there in chapter 4? For thyself. In verse 4, we read, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidot, she judged Israel at that time. She dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel and Mount Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. You see, she's not a prince of the tribe, but she is an established figure. She is a recognized leader of the people because she is recognized as an instrument that God is working through and is an established judge, even before she gets involved in the process of deliverance. So she is also upper crust, at least as the people that day would have interpreted it. Then we come down to the case of Gideon, and from what stratum of society do we see God plucking him, Mr. Knocker? Least clan in Manasseh. So he is a social nobody, and yet God chooses him. And then we have Jephthah, and from what stratum of society does he come from? Mr. Moeller? So obviously not exactly high-born. His father might have been prominent, but he certainly was not. So again, we've got a very person from the lower stratum of society, a social outcast. He was even rejected by his own people and made to dwell in a foreign area. And so we have in these an interesting illustration of the fact that as far as God is concerned, the servants he chooses to use in major ways, he doesn't particularly care one way or the other about social status at the time he chooses to call them and use them. And I think we've seen that illustrated at other periods of history too. That God chooses people according to his own criteria, not the way men would assign status to individuals. Now, in each case also, what is it that made these people successful? Enabled them to do the job they were commissioned to do? Was it Jephthah's vast military experience that was the key? Was it Gideon's superior bravery? Was it Deborah's innate qualities? And was it Ehud's bravery and ingenuity, etc.? What was the critical ingredient in each of the cases, Mr. Weed? Exactly, and also the fact that we see in almost every case, and we could presume it in every case, even though the Bible doesn't specifically mention it every time, but the pattern seems to be established, that God gave a portion of his spirit to each of the people he selected. If you look at Othniel and his calling, it says that Othniel delivered Israel, but then it said, shows that God, through his spirit, helped Othniel to do that. And that it talks about the spirit of God coming upon Jephthah before he went into battle. It speaks about the spirit of God coming upon Gideon before he went into battle. And Deborah, of course, was using Barak as the instrument and telling him that God had selected him and God would go with him, but that wasn't enough for Barak. He wanted the physical presence of Deborah. You see, faith was weak at that time, even as Gideon asked for proofs of God actually choosing him. It was not a period where faith was a strong commodity. So the critical ingredient was God's spirit. It didn't make a difference. Sure, some of these men had talents and abilities, but they all needed God's spirit in order to use those talents and abilities most fully. And so here we have a slide summarizing, as I say, their social origins, and seeing that these were immaterial to God in choosing whom he would work through. And sometimes we have to learn that lesson ourselves. You know, we're brought up in the world to automatically give more respect to people that are respectable already, and we tend to weigh people, even after we come into God's church, by those standards. And we have to recognize that if God is clearly working through an individual, it doesn't matter what he was before he received his calling. It matters the fact that God chose to call him. In the same way as these judges. That it didn't matter really whether they were high-born or not. God chose to call them and use them and give them this particular commission. And that's all that counted. Now, we do not consider Samson along with the other judges because Samson's particular oppression that he was responsible for relieving is the Philistine oppression, which began at the same time as Jephthah's problem with the Ammonites. But before we get into Samson, I want to cover one thing we left hanging about Jephthah. And that was the matter of the fact that the people of Gilead, the leaders, had advertised for a military man to relieve them of their oppression. And we find this in Judges chapter 10, at the end of the chapter. The people and the princes of Gilead said one to another, "What man is he that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead."
Now, what is it they offered Jephthah when nobody answered their advertisement, and they knew Jephthah was up there in the land of Tob, and they knew that he was an experienced military man? They went and asked him to serve them. What is it they offered him? Who found the offer? Paul? Yes, in verse 6 he said, "They said to Jephthah, come be our captain that we may fight with the children of Ammon." Now, is there any significance at all in the difference in words between the head that was promised, the position of headship, which was promised to whoever would fight the Ammonites, and this position of captain, which was offered to Jephthah? Well, one illustration in the text itself shows us there is a distinction. Where do you find evidence in the text that there is a distinction, that they're not just synonyms for the same office? Many of you forgot to do this. You got so excited about Educational Field Day. Bill Lingy. Right. In other words, there are two different offices. The head is one office. The captain is another office. And he filled both of them. Notice as we read the account, beginning in verse 6, they said to Jephthah, come and be our captain that we may fight against the children of Ammon. And Jephthah said to the elders, hey, wait a minute. You're coming to me that I should be your captain. Didn't you hate me and expel me out of my father's house? Didn't you run me out of town on a rail? So after treating me in this fashion, why are you coming to me now in your distress? And in other words, he wasn't taking their offer. The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, therefore we turn again to you now that you may go with us to fight against the children of Ammon. And now notice they changed their offer. They upped the ante. He didn't respond to the bait of the office of captain. So they up it to what they had previously advertised. And they say, and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And so Jephthah says to the elders, if you bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, and the Eternal deliver them before me, so he recognized what even he needed as an experienced military man, will I really be your head? You really mean to go through with that? And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, the Eternal be witness between us if we don't do according to our word. In other words, there's an oath-taking here that let the Eternal punish us himself if we don't faithfully perform this promise. And so Jephthah agreed to go with them, and he became both head and captain. Now, what is the difference between these two offices? Well, first of all, which is the higher? This is obvious from the text itself. The headship is higher, because they probably didn't think it was needful to offer him that high position, because after all, he was just a social outcast. You know, maybe he'd come for the lower position. And so when he didn't, they had to offer him the upper one. So the headship is up here, and the captain is here. Now, the Hebrew word for captain is nagid. I had to stop and think myself. Nagid. N-A-G-I-D. And is a Nancy, A-G-I-D. We transliterate it. Now, a nagid, it can be translated as captain, but it doesn't give you the flavor. The best translation is probably viceroy. Now, those of you from the Commonwealth or from Britain, one of you perhaps would like to explain to the class what a viceroy is, since you're more familiar with the usage of that term, or should be, I guess. Roger? Yeah. Yeah, not only representing the king, but there's another aspect of being a viceroy. Okay, the full authority and all the powers of the king or queen in that area. Now, in the modern Commonwealth system, the governor general would be the most applicable comparison. Because in Australia or Canada, the governor general exercises the powers of the queen in those countries to dissolve parliament, to grant pardons, etc., etc., you know, as those things go. This is what this term means. But in other words, it is not an independent authority. When he acts, he doesn't act on his own authority. He acts in the name of and by the authority of the higher ranking individual, you see. And so Jephthah wasn't interested in this lower ranking position. He knew that they had offered the top job to whoever would solve their problem, and he wanted them to fulfill the promise to him as well. And so he occupied, you see, in essence, both offices. Now, this is the actual executive office. This is more the titular head. And this is the one who actually carries out the actual responsibility, you see, who actually carries out the responsibility. And so he was given both offices, both the titular headship and the job involving carrying out the specific responsibilities. And this is an important term, not only because it reveals something that's interesting about human nature, that here they need a man to save them. And so they advertise, you know, the respectable people of their community, if any of you respectable people, men, will take on the responsibility, we'll make you the titular head of our whole tribe. But none of those, quote, respectable people are anxious. And they're forced to go to this social outcast, and they say, we can't make that social outcast our titular head. I mean, that's disgusting, the idea. We'll offer him the dirty work job, the one that has to do all the work, but we'll keep somebody respectable over him, you see. And Jephthah didn't like that idea. He insisted on being treated like anybody else. So there's a little bit of an interesting interplay of human nature here involved in the actions of the elders of Gilead and their relationships with Jephthah. So I just thought I would bring that out. One other thing I'd like to bring out in Jephthah's connection is a clarification of what Jephthah meant when he got ready to fight the battle. And he was assaying his forces against the forces of the Ammonites and recognized that he couldn't win or rely on winning unless God, of course, provided assistance. That what is it that he promised God? In verse 30, Jephthah vowed a vow to the Eternal and said, if you shall without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that it should be whosoever comes forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Eternal's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Now, God punished him by causing his daughter to be the one to come out first. Why did God do that? You see, some people have speculated, well, he meant an animal. Well, what would have been wrong then with offering that? But in the clearest sense of the word, it was a human being that he meant. Remember, this Jephthah was not totally Israelite, and he had been reared, or rather grown up a lot, in a non-Israelite area where human sacrifice was common. So he had a lot of wrong ideas. They weren't typical for an Israelite. But why is it that God chose to punish him? It wasn't just because he offered him a human being. What is it that was in this vow that God took great offense at? Sue? And usually that would be done by doing the sacrifice first, you see, and then binding God that way. So it wasn't so much that, but there was something in the way, the content of the vow. Gary? Yeah, because you see, if you notice what he's saying, he says, if you'll do what I request, I'll give you an offering. You know, whatever servant comes out, I'll make him a burnt offering. In other words, I'll take any one of my lowly servants and I'll use that. In other words, what does God expect when one makes an offering? The best, you see. So it's not, besides the fact that he's involved in a very wrong practice, you see, it's also he wasn't even willing to offer the best. To see both parts of that insult to God, to understand why God punished him so severely. And I know different scholars have debated the issue endlessly in print as to whether he ever did offer his daughter or not. And I think the preponderance of evidence seems to indicate that he did fulfill that particular vow. upon her urging. Remember, this was an age where Israel was not on track most of the time. And a lot of things went on then that would not have gone on in the days of the patriarchs or gone on in the days later in Israel under the righteous kings like David or Solomon or Hezekiah or Josiah. And this is just another insight into this very disturbed period of time, a very chaotic period of time. Okay, let's now get into this matter of the Philistines, and to assist us in considering the Philistines and their relationships with Israel, I've prepared a chart. Remember, this material on the Philistines will not be on the test on Monday. It will appear on the third test. The only reason we're doing this today is so that you don't get the test today, but have a little more time to prepare. Considering the Philistines, we can divide their periods of ascendancy over Israel into five phases, or at least their attempts to exercise authority over Israel into five phases. And I've tried to associate the significant individuals, biblical personalities who are associated with the various phases, and to give you an idea of the major events that transpire during each phase. Now, the term Philistine itself, used as a literary expression, especially among English and American writers, is used as sort of a derogatory term. To call somebody a Philistine is equivalent to saying that they're rather uncouth, uncultured type of people. And this is rather unfortunate because the Philistines had a very high level of culture. Their pottery was the finest, was much finer than anything that had been produced locally in Canaan. Their other arts of civilization were of a very high order. And so it's an unfortunate usage to describe somebody as a Philistine, meaning that they're uncouth and uncultured. The Philistines are a very important people in terms of the history of Israel because they represented the most serious military threat that Israel faced in the land of Canaan. You know, from within the land. I'm not talking about foreign oppressors like the Egyptians or the Babylonians or the Assyrians who came in from outside. I'm talking about from within the land itself. The strongest military threat that Israel ever faced came from the Philistines. In fact, for a time, if we had left God out of the picture, we just looked at the ebb and flow of Israelite-Philistine relations, and if you had been a commentator, a political commentator at the time, observing this relationship as it took place over several centuries, you would have been hard put to predict which of the two powers would have emerged as the victor. That it was sort of a nip and tuck type of struggle between the Philistines and Israel. And the price, of course, if the Israelites had lost, would probably have been the extinguishing of their not only independence, but of also possibly physically as a nation. And so it's obvious why God had to be a factor to prevent that from happening. The Philistines are also a very important figure in the biblical story because it was the Philistine threat more than any other thing which created the Israelite demand for a monarchy. Because when the people asked Samuel for a king, they weren't just asking for a king, as we will see later. And we take up the transitional period in which Samuel fits. They were asking for a monarchy. Now you might say, what's the difference between asking for a king and asking for a monarchy? Well, why don't you weigh that between now and Wednesday and see if you can figure out what the difference is between asking for a king and asking for a monarchy. Consider that the request came against the background of this very intensive and almost continuous military threat they faced from the Philistines. Now, the Philistines, their ultimate origins are a little bit obscure. We don't really know where exactly this people should be placed in terms of their origins. The Bible only mentions the place from which they sprang when they came to Canaan, which may be the place of their origins and may be only an intermediate point on their journey to Canaan. We don't know. The Bible very clearly tells us that they came from the island of Kaphtor, C-A-P-H-T-O-R, Kaphtor. And indeed, in other places, they are called Kerethites, Kerethites, which also is an allegation of this particular origin. Now, where in the world is Kaphtor? Based on other inscriptions, other documents from the Middle East, we feel that we should associate Kaphtor with the island of Crete. And it's interesting that the Philistines move into Canaan in extremely large numbers, although there's reason for believing that they were there earlier by small colonies, especially in the time of Abraham. They move in en masse around the years 1200 or shortly before. And it's interesting that on Crete, at about that period of time, the rich culture of Crete collapsed, just before the Philistines leave Crete and come into Canaan. And so there obviously is some sort of a connection between the collapse of the Minoan culture on Crete and the wanderings of the Philistines that eventually caused them to settle into Canaan. But the exact connection is obscure. We don't know if these are Cretans who then leave their native island and seek some other home, or if these were a subordinate subject people of the Cretans who were freed of their slavery, so to speak, by the collapse of that power and were then free to go elsewhere. We just are not all too clear on these points. One of the interesting things about the Philistines is that, of course, the question enters in, how could Abraham have had any relationships with Philistines? And some scholars are of the opinion that the mention of Abraham having a relationship with Abimelech, the Philistine king of the city of Gerar, where he palmed off again his wife as his sister, and Isaac having relationships with those Philistines, that that's an anachronism, that Philistines didn't exist in Canaan in that early period. However, even the great Albright admitted the following, that if we consider that the Philistines only arrived in Canaan around 1200 BC, we have an example which is unprecedented in terms of rapid acculturation by a foreign group to their new home. In other words, what Albright observed is, if one accepts the conventional view that there were no Philistines in Canaan until around 1200 BC, by 1100, it is amazing, 100 years or maybe less, they lose most of their unique Philistine attributes and become like the Canaanites. They adopt the Canaanite language. You ever wonder why Samson was able to talk to them very easily and be understood by them? You might not realize it, but even the riddle he gave, you know, with the honey and the lion, it's a play on words which is only applicable in Hebrew, which of course is a Canaanite dialect. How could they even have had a hope of understanding it? There would be no point to the riddle unless they were fluent with that language. And we know from other sources the Philistines did use the Canaanite dialect, which is, of course, almost the same as Hebrew. Their gods, who is one of the chief gods of the Philistines? Dagon. But Dagon is not a Philistine god. Dagon is a Canaanite god. So they've even adopted one of the local gods as their own. You see, they have acculturated to Canaan quite to a very great extent, and they did it with extreme rapidity. And that's why Albright said there's no other precedent in history for a cultural group coming to a new land and so quickly dropping, you know, that most of their old ways and picking up the new ways of their new land of residence. And of course, I think the answer lies in the fact that these people were helped to acculturate. That the Philistines had had trading colonies in Canaan before, who were acculturated. Now, how do we know that they were acculturated? Well, the Philistine king of Gerar, what is his name that Abraham dealt with? Abimelech. That is not a Philistine name. The captain of his host, who we read about in connection with Isaac, Pichol, that's not a Canaanite name. That's a Philistine name. But the king's name, Abimelech, is a good Canaanite name. So we have evidence that the Philistines that Abraham and Isaac had dealings with already were fairly acculturated to Canaan. And so therefore, when the main wave of Philistines came in, you can understand why they could quickly become acculturated, because they already had people of their ethnic group long resident in Canaan who were acculturated and could guide them and help them in this process. In the same way that many immigrant groups who have come to the United States and possibly also to Canada have been helped to acculturate to their new country by previous arrivals from their own group who have set up formal or informal programs to help them become acculturated to their new homes. And this, of course, greatly speeds the process. Yes, Mr. Mason. We don't know why. Whether they were the dominant power and when their power collapsed they needed to find a new home, or if they were more a subordinate race to the Cretans and held in some type of subjection on the main island, and when their Cretan power collapsed they were free to go elsewhere. And they chose to go to the location where some of their people had been placed. You see, the Cretans managed an enormous maritime commercial network in the eastern Mediterranean. And that would explain why they may have placed these colonies of Philistines not only in Canaan but elsewhere as well. And so they chose that particular location to go to. Okay, we'll pick up with these Philistines on Wednesday and finish the Philistines in connection with Samuel as well. And Monday, of course, we'll have our test. Let's get into the scriptures and take a look at what happened during this first phase. In Judges, we read about Samson. It also shows you that God used some interesting people as servants. In many respects, Samson is not your ideal individual. He made many, many mistakes. And even at the end of his life, it's not altogether sure he had what could be properly called in a New Testament sense an attitude of repentance and yieldedness to God either. Because even though he asked God for the strength he needed to carry out his last deed, willing to give his life in accomplishing it, it wasn't motivated so much by a noble aspiration. We can take a quick look at that just to see that particular point. In chapter 16, verse 28, Samson called to the Eternal and said, O Lord God, remember me, I pray you, and strengthen me, I pray you, only this once, that I may be at once avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. You see, the specific reason he asked for the strength was a very personal one. He brought down the temple of Dagon, thereby freeing Dan and Judah from Philistine oppression for a considerable period of time. But he wasn't motivated by an attitude of serving his people. He was motivated by a desire for personal revenge.
And as you look, if you take the time to go through all the chapters that deal with Samson, you'll find that almost every time he attacks the Philistines, it's not because he's acting as a conscious liberator of his people, but because he is motivated by desire for personal vengeance, to avenge personal wrongs. So as you say, he does not seem, at least, to rise above that. Now, maybe along with that, there was some deeper repentance, I don't know. But at least the way the scriptures give the account, one is left with a very strong impression that he was a man motivated by private vengeance, although God did use that man to accomplish a wider purpose. So this is something we might want to spend some time thinking about. Now, Samson is a Danite, and it says that he was, of course, picked out from birth to be a special servant to God, and as a consequence of that, he was not only not to eat anything that came from the vine or drink any strong drink, but he was also to keep his hair long because he was considered a Nazarite from birth. Now, this is an interesting thing because the normal Nazarite vow was one undertaken by an adult of his own volition. There was a free decision, and it was taken for a stated period of time during which they had no strong drink, and they didn't drink wine, and they didn't allow a razor to come upon their head. But when they had accomplished the period of that vow, they symbolized the end of the period by cutting their hair and also making certain offerings, and then, of course, they were free to eat and drink as they pleased, you see. But Samson was one particular individual who was designated Nazarite from birth. Who was another? Yeah, these are unusual circumstances where people were designated a Nazarite from birth. Notice to what it is that Daniel owed his success. We saw in earlier cases of the judges that, of course, it was the Spirit of God given to the judge that made his activities successful. In chapter 13 of Judges, we find that Samson grew and the Eternal blessed him. In verse 24, Judges 13, verse 24, verse 25, and the Spirit of the Eternal began to move him at times in the camp of Dan between Sohah and Eshtaol. You see, it was the guidance and power of the Spirit that made these things possible. Now, we know about his prodigious feats of strength, and sometimes, again, looking at things geographically, you can appreciate some of these feats as well. I'll come to an instance in a minute after we take a look at a couple more instances of this Spirit of God being the important influence in his life as far as his strength. Chapter 14, verse 19. It mentions the Spirit of the Eternal came upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and slew 30 men of them. His prodigious strength was a gift of the Spirit. We usually think about tongues and inspired preaching and healing as gifts of the Spirit. Well, they are. But so is this gift of strength that was given to Samson. It was not one that is commonly given in the New Testament era, but this is something that was a gift of the Spirit. Notice also in chapter 15, at another point of confrontation, in chapter 15, verse 14, when he came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted against him. The Philistines were in ambush against Samson at that time, and the Spirit of the Eternal came mightily upon him. And the cords that were upon his arms became as flax that was burnt with fire, and his hands loosed from off his bands, loosed from off his hands. And then, of course, he goes into very dramatic action here. Even in the instant when Delilah betrayed him and got out of him why he was so strong. And Samson said, it's because since I was born, a razor has not come upon my head. shave me, and I will be as weak as any man. And that is exactly what she did. She shaved off his locks, and she began to afflict him, chapter 16, verse 19, and his strength went from him. Mistakenly, in the popular image that Samson acquires in children's Bible stories, and sometimes others as well, is that the strength was in his hair. That the hair in some way gave him the strength. Because they read this verse and they see that that's what he said, and then when she shaves off his hair and begins to afflict him, his strength went from him. And then they don't read the next verse. She said, "The Philistines be upon you, Samson." He woke out of his sleep and said, "I will go out as at other times and shake myself." But he knew not that the Eternal was departed from him. And so they took him. God gave him this special gift of strength through his spirit because he was faithful to that Nazarite vow. When he broke it, by allowing himself foolishly to be shaved, God's spirit left him. In other words, not that God blamed him for being tricked by Delilah and falling asleep and letting her shave him, but he should never have told her what condition it was that he had to observe so that God was with him. In other words, he treated it so casually that it was an affront to God, and God therefore left him once the hair was taken. One little side comment of interest perhaps to some in this account. In verse 21, we read, "The Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza and bound him with fetters of brass, and he was grinding grain in the prison house." Now, many have read that and said, boy, that was awfully cruel. They were really taking their revenge on Samson. It wasn't enough just to have him as weak slave grinding out grain, which was horribly humiliating. A human being was not very efficient grinding out grain. That was work much better done by an ox or a horse. Much more efficiently done that way. This was a deliberate humiliation to put him to work grinding grain. But it seems like they had to also add to that insult the injury of putting out his eyes. It seems like they were carrying their cruel revenge to an extreme. And that's not the point. The main point of their revenge was to make him grind the grain. However, physically, if a person is set to grinding the grain by pushing that, sort of like a capstan on the ship, the millstone around, you have sort of spokes coming out of it, and you lean against the spoke and you move it around. That's usually a way of preventing it, so you get, person can keep going without getting dizzy in the same way. That's why they used to put out one of the eyes of the animal that did it, so that if they didn't get dizzy as they walked around. In this case, they put out both of his. As a human being, having a little more control maybe of his head, they thought it was more needful. But it's related to the practice of putting him to grinding the grain, which was a tremendous humiliation. In other words, in those days, when Jesus Christ washed the feet of his disciples, I don't think you can imagine the feelings they had, because that was something that only, as we know, menial servants did. It was humiliating to them that their master stooped to do that to them. And yet he was making a point that one shouldn't be afraid of doing menial service. And there were certain things in that culture all the way through up the time of Jesus where there was very clear understanding of what people of a certain stature did and what people of other stature did not do. There was a very strong feeling of social class. And so by making Samson do this, they were really getting at him, because this is something that no human being would be expected to do. This was beneath the level of dignity of a human being to be put to work in this fashion. Now, I mentioned that there was one prodigious act of strength in connection with Samson that a geographical orientation helps in understanding. And this has to do with when he was, dallying with a damsel late at night, let's say a damsel of uncertain virtue late at night, in one of the Philistine cities, in chapter 16. that it was known to the Philistines that he was in town, and they thought, okay, now we've got him. We will not only shut the main gate at night, which is normal, but we will take the back gate, which is normally left open, which is a small gate, which is normally left open all night for the convenience of the townsfolk. We will shut that as well, and then we will have at him in the morning. When he's still groggy, we'll seize him and do with him as we please. Well, Samson arose in the middle of the night, around midnight, and he went to the back gate, expecting to find it open, and found it wasn't open. And so he simply picked the gate off its hinges and carried it away. And as it says, when he did this particular feat, in verse 3 of chapter 16, he rose at midnight and took the doors of the gate of the city, meaning this back gate, and the two posts, and went away with them, bar and all, and put them upon his shoulders and carried them up to the top of the hill that is before Hebron. Now that still sounds like a prodigious feat, but it becomes even more prodigious when you look geographically and say, okay, here is Gaza, and here is Hebron. Now as the crow flies, that's 35 miles. And I'm sure he wasn't flying. And it becomes even more prodigious when you look at the landscape, the way the map defines the landscape, and realize that in almost every instance it's all uphill that he's walking. So I say you magnify this event several times over when you consider its geographic relationship, which of course did not have to be explained in these past days because people knew that. But not being acquainted generally with the land, we would miss that. Okay. Samson, by bringing down the temple of Dagon in his own head, as it says, destroyed so many of the Philistine lords, their military chiefs, that it broke the back of Philistine military power and thereby relieved the oppression over Israel. And so the portion of Israel, Dan and Judah, that was suffering was free from this Philistine control, and for a period of time remained so. But the Philistines regathered their strength, and in the days of Eli they had expanded up into this part of the coastal plain and had already established a major garrison at Aphek, when the Israelites decided to go into action. Now notice what they did in 1 Samuel chapter 4 and what they did not do. Actually, the first part of 1 Samuel 4, verse 1, really belongs to the previous chapter. It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense introducing the chapter in this way. So let's skip the first sentence and go on and get into the context. Israel went out against the Philistines to battle. Something is conspicuous by its absence. And that is that they didn't bother to ask God whether this venture would have his blessing or not. They just went out on their own accord. They pitched beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines pitched in an Aphek, or Aphek. And so as you can see, that they were just across from each other. Aphek is in the coastal plain right up against the foothills, and Ebenezer is right on the edge of the foothills. You can look down on Aphek. And I have done so just to get an idea of the lie of the land from that region. And this was a natural jumping off place for the Israelites to attack the Philistines. The Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. When they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines, and they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. Now, suffering this defeat, you might think back to when Joshua sent men up against Ai and suffered a defeat. What did Joshua do after they came back licking their wounds? Mr. Knocker? Yeah. But what did these people do? They start complaining. Why has the Eternal smitten us today before the Philistines? They ask that question, which is a good beginning point. God must have had a reason for doing that. Why did he do it? Then one would have expected them to go to God and say, show us what we are doing wrong that causes you to be angry with us, and not give us victory, but give us a defeat. That would have been the right response. But they don't do that. What do they do? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal out of Shiloh, or Shiloh, that when it comes among us, it may save us out of the hands of our enemies. What was their thinking process like? What were they thinking they would gain by bringing the Ark along to the battle? Mr. Fraser? Well, where did they ever get that kind of an attitude from? That you force a deity to do something for you. What a strange mentality. Strange for Israel, anyway. They hadn't been taught that mentality by God or by Moses or by Joshua. Where did they get that mentality from? Mr. Uda.